Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 185, recorded January 19th, 2015. Ron Wayne. Triangulation is brought to you by Lynda.com. Invest in yourself for 2015. Lynda.com has thousands of courses to help you learn new tech, business, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/triangulation. That's lynda.com/triangulation. And by FreshBooks, the simple cloud accounting solution that helps millions of entrepreneurs and small business owners save time billing and get paid faster. Join over 5 million users running their business with ease. Try it free at freshbooks.com/triangulation. And by HipChat Plus. Collaborate, save time, and be more productive with your teams. HipChat Plus is IM, video chat, plus file, code, and screen sharing, all in one place. Invite your team members and get a free 30-day trial of HipChat Plus at hipchat.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and get to talk to them for an hour, and it's always a lot of fun. And this show especially, I've been looking forward to. Maybe you know, if you're a fan of the history of Apple Computer, you might have read about the story of Apple Computer and one Ronald G. Wayne. When Steve Wozniak was 25 years old, Steve Jobs 21 years old, and they first conceived the notion of creating a company to sell the Apple I computer, they approached a coworker of Jobs at Atari named Ron Wayne. They said, "Can you help us form this company?" Ron agreed for 10% of Apple Computer. A little later on, maybe a few weeks later, he got cold feet, and he said, "You know what, guys, I'm afraid of incurring some liability here. Good luck. But I'll see you later." He went back to work at Atari, never made a penny off Apple Computer. If he had kept his 10% stake, who knows how much he'd be worth. But does he have any regrets? I don't know. Let's find out. Ron Wayne joins us now from his home in Pahrump, Nevada. Pahrump might ring a bell. I think that's where Art... Do you know Art Bell, Ron?
I've heard the name. I have never met the man. I understand he has a broadcast program that he comes on with every so often, yeah, but I have not heard it.
He's a ham also. So you look for a trailer with a big antenna out front. But I don't know if he's still doing radio. He was very famous national radio host for many years with a late night show in which he talked about flying saucers and all sorts of interesting things.
Okay.
So it's such a thrill to talk to you. You met Steve Jobs when you and he were both working at Atari. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. He was a consulting engineer. I was the chief draftsman and product development engineer and, for a period of time, international field service engineer for Atari. I worked for them for about 3.5 years. And Jobs and I became quite chummy during that period of time.
Now, I've read some of the stories about Steve at Atari. He was quite a character. Do you remember that side of him, the barefoot boy
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. He was a most unusual individual and had a characteristic of being extremely focused. He always knew exactly where he wanted to go, and you never wanted to get between him and it, or you'd wind up with footprints in your forehead.
Woz tells me that, too. Woz used to say, every time I'd come up with another idea, Steve would say, "Hey, that's a business."
Yes. Yeah, he was constantly looking for a business. At one point in time, he had, of course, knew that I had been in the gaming machine world, and I had a corporation of my own in Las Vegas previously, designing and building gaming machines, had several of them qualified with the gaming commission. And he walked into my office one day and said, "Hey, I can come up with $50,000. Suppose we go into the slot machine business." And I told him that would be the quickest way I could think of to lose $50,000. And that was the last we ever talked about it.
I think you had lost money by then, or was that later?
Oh, yes. No, it's the story of my life. Day late and a dollar short.
Now, Ron, you don't seem too unhappy.
I've always followed the same philosophy. Whatever happens, you deal with it. That's all.
Yeah.
I was a holder of about a dozen patents, and I'm not talking about flashlight keychains. I'm talking about fundamental concepts. And that was from 1964 to 1972. I had acquired a good number of product development patents. And out of all of those patents, which included, among other things, the first significant advancement in analog electric meters since Darcenval 150 years ago.
Wow.
And out of all those patents, what I recovered in round numbers was about as round a number as you could get.
Zero?
It took me quite a while. You know, absolutely nothing. I never saw a dime out of any of them. And it had taken me all those years, because I tend to be a little thick on these things, to realize that the U.S. is the only industrialized country in the world where it is not a crime to infringe on a patent. Which means, of course, that an inventor has the right to defend himself for 17 years against GE, Borg, Warner, Westinghouse, or whoever else wants to steal it from him in a civil court. And, of course, any civil attorney will tell you, whoever goes into court, like whoever goes into a poker game with the most money, is virtually guaranteed to win.
Yeah.
So the independent inventor is not appreciated in this country.
We on this show had Nolan Bushnell on not so long ago talking about those early days at Atari. I don't know how much Nolan remembers of Steve. It seems like you perhaps had more direct contact with Jobs during those years.
Oh, I'm sure that Nolan had extensive contact with Steve, and Steve was very productive and beneficial to Atari. I think the most significant situation was I was International Field Service Engineer at the time, and I used to get these communications from a company in Germany that had bought a huge, almost a warehouse full of Pong circuit boards that a lot of them weren't working very well. They had sent out a tech to help this guy get these boards working again. The guy was an absolute twit. I got these phone calls, very belligerent phone calls from Germany, you know, screaming about who's going to fix these boards for us. And finally, Nolan sent Steve Jobs out. Jobs went out there and just in a matter of days was just spitting these things out like popcorn. And the tone of the phone calls from Germany changed dramatically. He did a magnificent job, and of course, I'm sure that Nolan remembers that.
Oh, yeah. What was it that Steve Jobs had? You obviously, and Nolan Bushnell obviously, noticed something unique in this young guy. I mean, he was in his very early 20s.
And extremely aggressive and constantly searching for something, primarily some form of business. He was absolutely business motivated. And where Steve Wozniak built this personal computer as more or less a lark, everything that Wozniak did, he did for the fun of doing it. And Jobs saw it as a business venture and immediately focused himself on driving this into an enterprise. And that's when I came into the game and we founded the Apple Computer Company, which, of course, had nothing to do with the corporate entity that followed.
You know, by the way, Woz is, you know, still very much like that. He's really a jolly, fun-loving but brilliant engineer. Did Steve have any engineering skills at all, or was it all business for him?
I mean, no, he was quite skilled as a technician. He knew integrated circuit logic. He wasn't so much a creator of circuitry as a promoter of and developer of and marketer of. But he understood the technology, certainly.
It's a great combination, isn't it? Somebody with the drive and intelligence to recognize something technically good, to focus on the product. I mean, that's what Jobs did throughout his career at Apple Computer.
As a matter of fact, I was just going to say that Apple, for all it was Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
He had this talent for moving ideas and people around like pieces on a chessboard.
We're talking to Ronald G. Wayne. Our producer, Karsten, emailed me. He said, I have the Pete Best of Apple, the guy who was right there at the very beginning of Apple, but sold his interest in it, and for good reason. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. You're watching Triangulation on Twitter. Our show today brought to you by Lynda.com. Lynda.com is the place to go if you want to enhance your job skills, get better at your hobby. Are you into photography? No better place to go to learn more about photography, about Lightroom, about Photoshop. In fact, I'm watching Burt Monroy right now. He's done a great series on his latest painting in Photoshop, the Amsterdam Mist painting. And in fact, we had Burt on the show, you may remember. And he has done a series. Look how nitty-gritty this gets. And this is one of the things that I particularly like about Lynda.com. They do text transcription, so you can search for something. And then they take, these are long videos. They're an hour at a time. But what they do is they take it and divide it up into sections. So if you want to know about, creating a brick pattern, you could just jump right there and watch that and learn. I mean, this is the amazing thing about Lynda.com. There are 4,500 courses on Lynda.com covering, of course, the obvious stuff like programming, web development, visual design. But there's also stuff on photography, on business skills like making a resume, organizing your time, software training like Excel, WordPress, and Photoshop. In fact, there's so much on Lynda.com, so many good courses, all taught by experts who happen to be great teachers like Burt Monroy. You're gonna find something you're interested in. A great plan for 2015, improve your job skills, ask your boss for a raise, make yourself more marketable for a new job, maybe getting better at your hobby, setting new financial goals, finding a better work-life balance. Lynda.com can do it for everybody. Some of the courses I recommend: managing your time. That's a really useful course. The Photography One-on-One series is a great way to get started in one of the best hobbies, my favorite hobby. And there's a weekly series called Small Business Secrets. That's Dave Crenshaw, who's a really good small business coach, talking about all the things you need to know: accounting, marketing, management. I mean, they have got great stuff. And I have arranged for you to try it free for 10 days. How about that? Lynda, LYNDA.com/triangulation. With your membership, you get unlimited access to every course on Lynda.com, including access on iOS, Android. New courses they've added each week. If you want to keep your mind as sharp as Ron Wayne has kept his, keep learning and do it at Lynda.com. LYNDA.com/triangulation for your free 10-day trial. Lynda.com. Ron Wayne is our guest. He is talking to us, I think, is it dial-up from Pahrump, Nevada? It is so great to talk to you and meet you. Tell me how the idea for the Apple Computer Company arose and how you came to be involved in it.
Well, it's a fairly well-known story, I think. Jobs came into my office one time at Atari and said he was in this club with Steve Wozniak and some other kids putting together personal computers engineered out of and business computers that were floating around at the time. Of course, there was no personal computer. And Wozniak had come up with this dedicated circuit, a very efficient circuit, for a personal computer. And he thought of it as something that would be a really great product. However, he was having a problem with Woz, in that Woz was not all that business savvy and couldn't understand the demands of a partner in an enterprise. As a matter of fact, Woz, among other things, was rather parental about the circuits that he came up with, and wanted to reserve the right to use this these basic circuits for other applications besides the computer. And Jobs was trying to explain to him that, you know, you really can't do that. This would be proprietary to any company we would form, and you couldn't have this circuitry floating around, possibly to be picked up by competitors. And he was having this terrible problem, but he felt that I, as, you know, 20 years older than he was, and he had some modest respect for me. He thought perhaps I could help him to resolve the issue. So I had them come over to my apartment that evening, and we sat around and we chatted. Waz was a reasonable guy. All that had to be done was to, you know, lay it out to him in a reasonable way, and he picked it up more or less on the first bounce and understood that, okay, this is proprietary, and he couldn't use it in other applications. Jobs was apparently so impressed with my abilities, my talents as a mediator or as a negotiator, thought that it would be best if I was in the enterprise. So he immediately said, look, we're going to form a company, and Jobs and Waz would each get 45%, and I would get 10% as the tiebreaker in case any problems came up in the future. And that was how it all started. The next day, we went down to the registrar's office in Santa Clara County and registered the Apple Computer Company. There were some concerns that developed over the next several days, not the least of which was the fact that this was a company, not a corporation, and therefore any problems that came up of a financial nature, Jobs and Waz didn't have two nickels to rub together, and I had a house and a car and a bank account and all the rest, so I was reachable and nobody else was. So that was one reason why I decided maybe it wasn't such a swift idea for me to be involved in this. But there were many other ideas equally as sound for me to separate myself from the enterprise, not the least of which was the fact that I was a product development guy in my own right, and I had been involved in engineering for the preceding 20 years. I wanted to be able to do projects of my own as well, but I knew that I was standing in the shadow of giants and that I would never get a project of my own. In addition to that, when I had gone into Atari, which was only about 3.5 years old, when I got into it, Nolan Bushnell had the same suffering that many creative people have. And that is this compelling drive to get the product out on the market as soon as possible. And anything that gets in the way of that is just an irritant, like how to set up a drawing number system. As far as he was concerned, your first drawing is drawing number one, your second drawing is drawing number two. And it doesn't work that way. I'd been in the business long enough to know you needed a meaningful numbering system that would enable you to retrieve information that you were putting into the documentation system. And the numbering system was critical in being able to do that. In addition to that, they had this huge inventory of components and materials and no documentation system that controlled their purchase parts. I eventually had to go in and tell Mr. Al Alcorn, who was the chief engineer at that time, that I'd been in their stockroom and I'd seen all this stuff, and said, you know, you got $500,000 in inventory, might just as well be in concrete. Yes. You're never going to get any of it out of there. I said, we've got to do something about this. And Al Alcorn says, no, we don't. You're the chief draftsman. You do something about it. So I spent the next 6 months building a purchase parts numbering system and documentation system that finished with a manual of about 300 pages that included all of the documentation for any purchase parts they could possibly ever want, with a guarantee that you could never have more than one number for one part or one part for one number. Anyway, Jobs was very impressed with that system that I had set up for them. In fact, I'm sure that he took a copy of that manual with him when he founded the corporation. I could see that Jobs really wanted me to run the documentation system at Apple. And being a product development guy, I didn't see myself sitting in a back room shuffling papers for the next 20 years. So that was another reason why I pulled out. There were other reasons as well, but those were basically the reasons why I separated myself from the company.
And as you've
to
said,
clarify this, and it needs clarification.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that there are people floating around with the idea that somehow or other I got diddled out of something.
Right.
I never got diddled out of anything. I did exactly what I wanted to do, and nobody, we parted absolutely friends, and we're friends for the next 10 years, no problems.
You were also a pretty fair artist. I'm looking at the original, the very first Apple Computer Company logo, and it is said you drew this?
Yes, I drew that of pen and ink. I was very fond of pen and ink at that time.
It's beautiful.
And the logo, of course, I had caught some of Steve Wozniak's whimsy, and I decided on this very whimsical approach to this so-called logo. I knew it wasn't a modern 20th century logo, that it really wouldn't work in today's world, but it was fun doing, and it seemed to fit all of the characteristics of the people who are involved in this.
For those who are listening, it says in a beautiful banner flowing in the wind, Apple Computer Company, and it's wrapped around what looks like almost like a book plate of Sir Isaac Newton sitting under a tree with a glowing apple about to fall on his head, and of course, apocryphally, give him the idea for gravity. And it has the inscription, Newton, a mind forever voyaging through strange seas of thought alone. Were you a fan of Isaac Newton?
The last line of Well, that's a very famous last line of a very famous Wordsworth poem.
Mm-hmm. I love it. It's very literate. You know what's interesting is...
And I thought it fit perfectly.
It did. And I think what this... You're right. This is, of course, the modern Apple logo is a streamlined and, in fact, doesn't even have color in it. But this really kind of reflects the whimsy that surrounded the earliest days of personal computing. I mean, this is the very earliest days. Software came in baggies, not boxes. And there was a certain hobbyist whimsy to the whole thing. And this was it. I mean, you're selling a wooden computer. So it couldn't have been...
It was a wonderful thing to be at a turning point in history. And it was a turning point in history, although, of course, we didn't know it at the time.
Right.
You needed the perspective of time to see that. But,
but
it was nice to have been there.
Oh, no kidding. So you said you stayed in touch for a decade or so with the Apple folks. Do you talk to Steve Wozniak at all anymore?
Oh, yes. I've had several conversations with him. It had been a number of years. It was interesting. About 3 years ago, I was at a Macworld convention for another purpose. And across this crowded room, here comes Steve Wozniak, this teddy bear of a guy, comes charging across the room and greets me like a long-lost brother. We had a wonderful two-hour conversation.
That's Woz.
Wozniak is the most gracious man I've ever met in my life.
Absolutely lovable, and teddy bear is the right word. And he never lost any sense of joy and fun at this whole thing. And it sounds like, in the Walter Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs, I think you're quoted as saying that Jobs was fairly cold even then.
Yes, but then he was a very focused person. I think the expression at the time was, if you had your choice between Steve Jobs and an ice cube, you'd nuzzle up to the ice cube for warmth. this is the sort of personality that it took for someone to do what he did with Apple. If you recall the history of Apple, as long as he was there, first of all, there's an unsung hero in the Apple story, and that is a guy named Art Rock. Somehow or other, they got together with Art Rock, and Rock was a finder. He was a finder's finder. He came up with $25 million to start up the Apple Corporation. But the most important thing was that Rock was smart enough to understand that when you put money together with ideas, the ideas should have control and not the money, which is a very rare thing. And because of that, Jobs and Woz had control of Apple Computer, until finally the Enterprise had to sell off stock in order to develop the things they wanted to develop and so on. And they developed a board of directors. And finally, at some point in time, Jobs got into an altercation with the board of directors, and effectively he lost. So he left.
Yep.
And once he left, the whole corporate entity went right down the toilet.
It withered.
Until Jobs came back, and then it started all up again.
Yep. That's one of the great stories in American business, is this notion of this guy who was single person, so important to a company, now the most valuable company in the world, that without him, they almost went bankrupt. They came within 100 days of going bankrupt. It is a remarkable story. Mm-hmm. Did you stay in touch with Jobs at all? He doesn't seem like the warm and fuzzy type, sending Christmas cards and stuff.
No, I had a couple of conversations with him over the next several years. The actual whole story of my relationship is in my book, Adventures of an Apple Founder, that can be gotten at Amazon. And the story of my relationship with him during the Enterprise at the beginning and in the years that followed is in there in detail.
Yeah, everybody should read that, because that's, I think, kind of sometimes an overlooked part of Apple history. And you were there at the very beginning. I mean, Steve Jobs was 21 years old when you founded the first iteration of the Apple Computer Company. And that's pretty amazing, isn't it? It's not your only book, though. I want to talk about The Insolence of Office, too. We're talking with Ronald G. Wayne.
Oh, really?
Yeah, why not? Ron, you wrote it. Let's talk about it. I bet you don't get, you know, a lot of people writing school papers on that.
I am delighted.
Right. He is Apple co-founder Ron Wayne. I mean, I like that. Although his investment, he was bought out of you didn't make a financial investment in any way. Did you put up capital of any kind?
No.
No.
I had nothing invested in it. No.
Yeah.
My time and effort. And, of course, I went on working with him after I separated myself from the company.
Well, we'll talk about that, too. Lots more to talk about. Ron Wayne, our guest mm-hmm. on Triangulation. FreshBooks is really a great, simple, they call it a cloud accounting solution. It does the things you most need to do if you're a freelancer, a small business, the things you least want to do. Things like sending invoices, pain in the butt. When I had to send invoices, I never did it. I never got paid. I was very fortunate back when I was working in Canada that Amber told me about FreshBooks, and it changed my life. You set up your invoices. They look beautiful, professional. They're easy to fill. In fact, they're even easier because if you use the FreshBooks apps on your iPhone or your Android device, it'll keep track of time and hours and just goes right into the invoice. Same thing with expenses. You take pictures of the receipt, goes right into the invoice. You can bill in any currency. I used Canadian dollars all the time to bill Rogers. That was awesome. You know, FreshBooks has discovered that on average, FreshBooks customers get paid 5 days faster. That's because they invoice on time, and it makes it easy for your client to pay. There's a big pay me button, and they accept all kinds of payment systems online and off, credit cards, etc. Turns out clients do want to pay you. They're just as lazy as you are. They get around to it when they get around to it. Make it easy for them. And by the way, if you've got a slow pay, FreshBooks will automatically send out little reminders that they're getting a little behind. You don't have to have that embarrassing phone call. FreshBooks customers on average, double their revenue in the first 24 months. Isn't that awesome? And they spend less time on paperwork, freeing up on average 2 days a month. Focus on the work you love, not the paperwork. FreshBooks.com. I want you to try it today. We've set up a 30-day free trial with no obligation at FreshBooks.com/triangulation. I'm telling you, it's good. If you're a small business owner or a freelancer, you will thank me later. I can promise you. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. All I ask when they ask you, how'd you hear about us? You just write triangulation in that little field there, okay? Just give us some credit. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. Ron Wayne is our guest. He is it's a really great story. And it's often told, I think, as if you said it yourself. You somehow gotten screwed out of being a billionaire. They estimate, at least on Wikipedia, that given Apple's current worth, your 10% would be worth somewhere around $35 billion today. Does that give you a sick feeling?
Which is an inaccurate representation.
Good. Tell me about
that. It's an inaccurate representation because, well, Jobs did not hold on to his 4 or 5%, nor
True.
Did Wise.
True.
This all got diluted down as they acquired funding later on. My 10% would have probably been down to a half of 1% by the time that the enterprise really succeeded to where it was.
That's actually a very good point. In fact,
so, you know, this idea that I would have been a billionaire is erroneous.
In fact, most of Steve's estate, his fortune, came out of the Disney shares that he got when Disney acquired Pixar. I think Apple, by the end, for both Woz mm-hmm. and Jobs, wasn't, I mean, it was, okay, hey, a few hundred million here or there. It's not chicken feed, but it isn't the billions that one might expect. But you don't seem to have any regrets at all.
No, why would I have regrets? I was a part of history.
Yeah.
That alone is enough to, to satisfy me. Look, in all my life, I've tried to be a millionaire. I never succeeded. Nothing ever seemed to work out business-wise. But the reality is that while I've never been rich, I've never been hungry either.
Yeah.
And I pretty much did things the way I wanted to do them and explored the worlds I wanted to explore and had fun doing it.
I don't think you can ask for much more from life. And I think many of the people who've devoted their lives to becoming rich are not necessarily that happy. So the heck with it. It's just
well,
money.
this is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a philatelist.
Yeah, that means stamp collector to some people who might not know the term.
I'm not accusing you of anything nefarious.
I remember seeing a news broadcast one day of this man on the street with a microphone talking to people walking up and down the street. This was in San Jose at the convention center. And he stops this guy on the street and he says, you know, there's a philatelic convention going on in there. And this guy comes back with, they shouldn't even let those people in town.
You stamp collector. The reason I know that is because the Apple logo you drew for Apple resurfaced as Wayne's Stamp Company.
Yes. Yeah, I did that once. Yes.
I think that's great.
I had a stamp store. It was fun.
Why waste a beautiful
I also
logo?
Deal in coins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
I have no idea where the original of that is, and I imagine it's probably in the Apple archives.
I would hope that it gets into a museum or something somewhere, because it's a work of art. I mean, it's really beautiful. And as I said, it does encapsulate in some interesting way the spirit, the style of the early days of personal computing. I think it's wonderful, and it's you're a great artist. I mean, I really now. You did say you were a draftsman, so obviously you have some talent with the pen.
Oh yes,
yeah. I just love it.
50 years a draftsman. I didn't even do AutoCAD until 2002.
Wow. Do you own any Apple products?
No, I was given one once. I gave it to my adopted son to learn how to use it and then show me. Of course, my chances of ever getting it back are somewhere between slim and none, and slim's out of town.
It never returned, huh? That was an iPad.
That was
an iPad that you got.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that. So you had no desire when this thing starts taking off a few years later, and they're making the Apple II, and then 10 years later they're making the Macintosh. You had no desire at any time to say, "Gee, I wonder what the boys came up with."
I never even owned a computer until 95.
Okay.
And people would ask me what sort of computer I've got. And I said, what do I need a computer for? And if you tell me anything you want, I'm going to come across the table at you. I had to have a reason for having it.
Oh, you're nuts.
And
that's crazy.
It was 95, I think, when that reason finally came up.
Right.
Somebody asked me to write a short story for him, which I did. And turned it out in a typewritten manuscript, and I sent it off to him and waited for a couple of weeks and never got an answer. And finally, I got in touch with him. I said, what do you think of the story? He said he couldn't see it through the tears. Could I send it to him in a form he could use, like WordPerfect? Okay, so fine. I went out and I had somebody build me a computer that had just the things on it I wanted, internet and a word processor and so on.
Oh, what a hoot.
And that was my first computer in 95.
If you had just saved one of those
I had to have a reason. Otherwise,
if you just saved one of those Apple Ones, you know, in October, an Apple One was sold at auction for $905,000. That's a record amount for the Apple
right?
One.
And I was just involved in the selling of a second Apple. It went out of Christie's about a month ago.
Oh, really? How so?
Yes. Okay. A gentleman, Mr. Luther, had bought an Apple One out of a garage sale.
Yeah.
For $7,600 many years ago, and had then gone about very meticulously arranging with Christie's to sell it at auction. The auction is held on December the 11th, I think. At any rate, he got in touch with me to help him provide some advertising support for his marketing of this. He knew that I had some documentation that I was trying to find a home for from the early days of Apple, a manual and some other, and the original drawings that I had done for the Apple II enclosure. And I was trying to find a home for that documentation package. So he said, all right, we'll do it together. And he then proceeded to work with me to get those things put together, and he arranged with Christie's to market it. And they both sold at auction on the same day. It was an interesting thing because we expected, with all the advanced news releases that went out on that auction, that we were both going to do very well on, especially since only a month before, an Apple had sold for $900,000,
right,
which meant that there had to have been a number of bidders in there who lost out. So we figured that was going to happen. Well, unfortunately, for whatever reason, it didn't happen that way. He sold his Apple for $300,000, and my archive of documents, there were 35 pieces of documentation there, which we figured would go for 30 to 50, actually went for 20. But it all went at auction, and I'll pick up a little money to help me in my retirement.
Nice. You did. I seem to remember you were a technical writer, so you wrote that first manual, didn't you?
I wrote a good part of it, although the technical aspects came from Wozniak.
Right.
But I did do the warranty and a few other things.
That's neat.
And, of course, I organized the first manual. I took the text and put it together for the first manual.
Yeah, look at this. Apple Computer Company.
I also did the schematics.
770 Welsh Road,
yep.
Palo Alto, 94304. And there's your beautiful... I would get this just for the book plate, the Isaac Newton book plate. That is gorgeous. You can't see it, I know, but we're looking at an image of the manual. It's just really, it's really, really pretty. And I thought that this Christie's lot was really great because not only did it have one of the first 25 Apple Ones, but it had that manual and a schematic, both signed by Woz. You would think that would go for some a pretty. I guess $300,000 is a pretty penny. That's not bad. Pretty cool stuff.
It is, but it was sort of disappointing after the first one had gone for $900.
Yeah. No, I understand. It is amazing to see how far we've come in the little less than 40, is that right? 40 years since then. It's it's been a remarkable journey. You have, as I mentioned, had a number of other careers, including stamps and coins. But also author, I want to talk about, I'm very curious about, Insolence of Office, which is a book you published right about the same time that you published the memoirs as an Apple founder. We're talking about Apple's first parental supervision, Ron G. Wayne, and we'll have more in just a bit after this word from HipChat. Our show today brought to you by HipChat. HipChat is something I can't remember when I first used HipChat, but we really started using it seriously during our web design process. We were working with a company in Austin, Four Kitchens, to do a new website. And, okay, so the company's in Austin. We're here in Northern California. Their team is distributed. Our team is distributed. HipChat allows us to get together, to collaborate, to work together. Not just chat, although I have to say, even the chat is very, very valuable. And by the way, it records, it keeps the chat forever, basically. So you can, just like email, go back in time. Easy and more immediate than email. I think a lot of teams are discovering that HipChat Plus especially is a great way to communicate as a team. We liked it so much with the web team that we're using it in engineering now. We're going to use it in sales. It brings together all of the kind of tools you need, instant messenger, but also video chat, document sharing, screen sharing, system updates, code sharing, all integrated into a simple platform, HipChat Plus. Email, too slow. Meetings, get sidetracked. Regular instant messenger isn't designed for business, for groups. For one thing, it's not secure. HipChat is fully secure. I love it. It keeps your team in sync, and it works from any device. There's a web interface that you can use literally anywhere, including a Chromebook. But there are also HipChat apps for iOS and Android, for iPad. I keep HipChat running everywhere so that I'm always in touch with my team. I always know what's going on. There's even secure guest access. So you can bring in a third party, a client or a vendor into a HipChat room. You control what they see. I just love it. It integrates with all the top developer tools, too. That's one of the reasons we use it. GitHub, Jira, Zendesk, HipChat. Actually, 57 different services. You'll see them all there. HipChat.com/triangulation. I want you to try it free for 30 days. Now, this is HipChat Plus. This is the premium version. After 30 days, you can continue using it. There's a free version. We used that for a long time. Now we pay for it because it really is worth it. HipChat Plus. HipChat.com/triangulation. And for the first 100 of you that sign up, we're going to make it a 90-day trial. That's just to encourage you not to waste time. Go to HipChat.com right now and get on that 90-day trial. HipChat.com/triangulation. HipChat, your team, your project in sync instantly. So this looks like a book about politics. A hobby of yours?
Not exactly.
Okay.
More than that, a major interest of mine. The first two-thirds of the book deals with the history of governance, starting with the origin of kingdoms and how kingdoms evolved eventually into our modern constitutional republic. And it discusses our constitution, the forces that shaped it, and what has happened to that constitution from then to now. But more important, I think, than that is the last third of the book, chapter 5, which is called The Nature of Money. Ah. And this is a vital piece of information for people who are not familiar with this. And the vast majority of people haven't got a clue as to what money really is and what isn't money. And what that story does on chapter 5 is it goes back to the beginnings, way back to the time of barter, and how money came into existence, and how without the advent of money, the modern world would not have been possible. For no other reason, the simplest explanation is you couldn't barter together an automobile.
Right.
You needed a currency system that would enable people to become specialists.
Right.
To do one kind of work and be paid in a form that would be universally accepted by other technicians who worked in specific disciplines, and that made the modern world possible. But where this all began, I was, of course, born in 1934, the tail end of the Great Depression and World War II. There was a particular event in my life that I would regard as a turning point. I had heard a conversation between relatives talking about either a family friend or a distant relative, I didn't know exactly who, describing this gentleman who at the time was really quite successful. He had a house, more unusual, he had a car. He was not only building a business, but buying the building the business was in. He was extremely conservative and would never gamble on anything. He wouldn't play cards. He wouldn't go to the races. He certainly wouldn't bet on stocks and bonds. And all of a sudden, he goes to the bank one day And for all practical purposes, it's a hole in the ground. The bank had failed. And when that bank had failed at that time, there was no Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. When that bank failed, it took everything he owned with him. And it bothered me, even as a kid, that somebody could play the game by the rules and still get steamrolled. And I thought, I ought to know something about this, or I myself could be vulnerable. And I started asking a lot of questions. But the answers I got were, one, all different, and two, really didn't make a whole bunch of sense. Like, you know, the price of gold. Somebody sits in an office someplace and makes an arbitrary decision, and everybody goes along with it. It didn't make any sense to me. So I spent the next 10 years, I would guess, asking questions and trying to understand. And it was, I think I was probably around 20, when suddenly one afternoon, the whole thing came together. It was like an epiphany. And all of a sudden, I suddenly realized how this whole system worked. And two questions immediately popped into my head. The first was, this is so simple. Why had it taken me all this time to understand it? And the second question was, why doesn't everybody understand this? And then I spent the next 50 years of my life trying to get people to understand. And the problems that result when a country goes to fiat money, to money by decree. Before World War II, there was only one currency in the world. It was gold. And everybody's currency was backed by gold. And gold had been currency for 3,000 years. It had worked very successfully. But not to get too elaborate on it, the World War II turned out to be the most expensive war in human history. And the net result was all the major countries in the world went bankrupt and decided to solve their problem by going to what's called fiat money. Money by decree, money because they say it's money, money that has absolutely no backing behind it. Well, the one problem with fiat money is that it always inflates itself out of existence, and for a very specific reason. And that is that if you were on a gold-backed currency, for example, the administrators of any government, it could be a dictatorship, a kingdom, a republic, it didn't matter. Whoever's administering that government, whatever it is that they want to do or have to do, they got to pay for it. And they've got to pay for it in gold and silver. And the only place to get that gold and silver is from the public. They got to tax it out of people's pockets. And you can't do that in secret. And that's when the public really gets their vote, asking the politicians, you want this money for what? And the politicians better come up with a good answer, or they're going to be out of office, especially in a republic. But when the world went to fiat money, the temptation on the part of the political leadership of all the countries in the world to turn the little handle and run off a few more is politically irresistible. The net result is these currencies always inflate themselves out of existence. Well, that was all established at the Bretton Woods Conference in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire in 1944. The countries decided they were going to go to fiat money. And from then until now, the whole world, including the United States, has experienced a 2,500 to 4,000% inflation, and that inflation is geometric. It's going up faster and faster and faster as time goes on. We probably have another half dozen years to go before the whole world's worthless paper money system collapses and we return to the gold and silver that was money for 3,000 years. Because people don't understand this. They're going to get hit by an economic tsunami and wonder what the heck happened. Those who do understand will recognize that yesterday's money is also tomorrow's money, and we'll have gathered up enough gold and silver to be able to get anything they want. And that's basically what my book is all about, explaining all this and encouraging the readers of my book to not take my word for anything, but look at the facts that I present as the basis for my arguments. And confirm those facts for themselves. So that's something I should do with any thesis that anybody gives them, is to check the facts for themselves. Once they've done that, they know whether or not the thesis is valid. And that's what my book is all about.
The book is available on Amazon, Insolence of Office. I love the name. Sociopolitics, Socioeconomics, and the American
Republic. It's also available on Kindle or iTunes.
Awesome. Now, okay. Are you up on Bitcoin? Because, you know, I think that the timing is good for this book. Maybe you wrote it a little bit too early. Because now, because of Bitcoin, which is also a fiat currency, but a cryptocurrency, computer-generated cryptocurrency. There's a lot of interest in all of this. So your timing, now is the time. You might get this book, start beating the drum on this book.
I wish I could. Unfortunately, it hasn't had adequate marketing, and because of that, it hasn't been out there in the world. I was hoping that one of the famous talking heads would get a hold of this book and understand it and recognize that this is something people have to know about. Bitcoin, as far as I am concerned, is a scam, and it's doomed, absolutely flat-out doomed to failure. Whoever gets caught in its meshes will be crushed by it.
Wow. I kind of agree with you on that one, but you and I seem to be in the minority. Ron, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. The original adult supervision at the Apple Computer Company, the guy who created the first Apple Computer logo, helped write the first manual, and is comfortably ensconced in Pahrump, Nevada, watching the explosion of the world's most valuable company. It seems like, though, you're feeling okay. You feel like, life has been interesting.
Yes, it has. I've enjoyed it, pretty much enjoyed it thoroughly. And let me take this opportunity, by the way, to thank you for the opportunity to get insolence of office in front of the public so that there's a chance that they might find out for themselves what it's all about and protect themselves.
There's a lot of interest in this right now. Your timing is very good. In fact, I see some people in our chat room have already bought copies. It's on, as you said, Amazon, Kindle, and iTunes. Insolence of Office, look for it, by Ronald G. Wayne. And it has been a thorough pleasure to talk to you, Ron. Thank you for taking some time out. And I hope that kid who's doing the school paper on you calls right after this, because you're all ready to go. We've warmed you up. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, sir.
A real pleasure to talk to you. Ronald G. Wayne. It's nice to have some adult supervision once in a while. Triangulation is every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That's 1900 UTC if you want to watch live. I love it when you watch live, because then we can interact via the chat room. But, of course, we make on-demand versions available always after the fact, audio and video. You'll find it on our website, twit.tv/TRI, or on YouTube, youtube.com/triangulation, or on iTunes, or wherever you can find your podcast. And we have apps, too, thanks to, not us, we didn't write them, our great third-party developers like Mark Hansen and Craig Mullaney, who've done great jobs on iOS, Android, Windows Phone, Dimitri Lialin, Roku, wherever you watch lovely video shows like this, talking about topics you will never see on CNN. This is the show you want. Triangulation. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Jason Howell for running the board. Thanks to my producer, Karsten Bonney. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.